afflicted, and each of them will burn before it fully infects them. It is a foul practice. I would never sully my soul in such a way."
Wesson turned to the older man.
The man would not meet his gaze. "It was you, then? You learned the spell for the ward?"
His voice was gruff as he said,
"Yes. I made the deal with the demon inside me. Now that you have felt it, you must know that is not true. The sensation, it is not one of evil."
The man scowled.
"I know nothing of the sort."
Wesson looked at the younger man.
"You could perform the spell as well, if you learnt."
The younger man lifted his chin defiantly.
"No, I cannot. My power is blessed of the Maker. I will not let the demons in." "How many have you helped to kill?"
The young man's eyes shimmered with pride.
"I have participated in 12 purifications. We cleansed the afflicted and their families. All of those communities are now safe from the putridity of the scourge."
Wesson felt anger and sorrow welling within him in equal amounts.
"The talented are not born evil. Learning spells does not make us evil. How we choose to use the talent is what makes us heroes or monsters. You choose to use yours to hunt down and kill innocent people. You cannot blame your actions on demons. You are humans. Humans choosing to do evil."
His senses overwhelmed, Wesson turned away. Rezkin stepped forward and started to speak, but the mage whipped around and shouted,
"Have you ever even seen the power in use? I mean, more than your meager ward. Have you seen someone use it to create a beautiful statue, construct a building, draw water from the earth, or to make a plant grow? How about healing? Have you ever watched someone return from the edge of death? All tricks of the demon to entice you into giving over your soul,"
said the younger man. He glanced at his partner and said,
"Even the enticement of protecting your brethren."
The old man pursed his lips, then spat with ferocity.
"It is true, but it was a sacrifice I was willing to make to continue the Maker's work and to protect others who do so. I hate myself a little more each time I feel the filth spread through my body, but I would do it again."
Wesson's face heated and he spun on his heel.
"They're a lost cause."
"What do you wish to do with them?"
said Rezkin. Startled, Wesson said,
"What? You asking me?"
Rezkin tilted his head.
"You are my mage. They are your responsibility."
"I am your mage? You mean I'm the..."
"Of course."
Wesson glanced at the two interested purifiers.
"May we speak elsewhere?"
Rezkin nodded to Farson to replace the shackles, and he waved Wesson through the door. Once they were outside, Wesson hissed,
"I'm only a journeyman. I cannot be the king's mage."
"According to whom?"
Rezkin said.
"The king's mage should be an archmage. I'm not even a full mage, much less a master mage, and I will probably never reach the level of power and skill required to be an archmage."
"I am the king, and I decide who is the king's mage. It is you."
Rezkin tilted his head and said,
"Unless you are tendering your resignation."
"What? No, but I have not even sworn fealty to you."
"I do not require it. If you are not resigning, then you are the king's mage. What do you wish to do with the prisoners?"
Tears welled in Wesson's eyes.
"I'm not cut out for this kind of position."
Rezkin's cool blue gaze seemed to glow in the moonlight.
"You are exactly the kind of person the king's mage should be."
Wesson blinked away the moisture. He choked down the tightness in his throat and said,
"They have confessed to their crimes. They have hunted, tortured, and murdered, but we are not in Ishai or Kyle. In Gendishan, these are not crimes."
"So long as they are committed against the talented,"
said Rezkin.
"Should their actions perpetuate just because it is accepted in their culture?"
"Of course not, but you are trying to create a kingdom that depends on being in Privath's good graces. If we stop making trouble, at best, he will call us murderers. At worst, he will consider it an act of war."
"Actually, the second scenario would be better,"
Rezkin mused.
"How is declaring war better?"
"Because that would mean he recognizes us as an independent kingdom.
Wesson scowled at him, and he said, "As far as making trouble, we've already done that. We killed 50 soldiers, including several officers who are probably members of noble houses, and will suddenly become valued once they hear the men are dead and that we killed them. It would be easy to cover this up. We could kill the survivors and mercenaries and then travel cross-country to avoid encountering anyone on the road who might make the connection. Or we could kill everyone we encounter, but I think that would be counterproductive." The light of the moon and the few torches still scattered around the yard was enough to expose Wesson's horrified expression. "Be calm, journeyman. I have no intention of doing those things. I know you and the others would be uncomfortable with such actions."
"Uncomfortable is an understatement," Wesson said. "And I have concerns that it seems to be the only thing holding you back."
Rezkin shrugged. "What do you want to do with them?" Chapter 3
"What's wrong with him?" Malsius asked.
Rezkin glanced at the mage who had been sulking in the corner all night. His mood had not improved, and he looked haggard in the morning light. His present drab countenance mirrored the functional and austere Gendishan style of the room. "His emotions have won the battle for his mind. Eventually, rationality will triumph. For now, he has a job to do, and so do you."
Malsius looked at Wesson doubtfully.
"Do you really think this is the best solution?"
"We can do it this way, or we can kill them all. Letting them go is not an option."
"All right, but I'm still not convinced." "It is disconcerting," Malsius said with a shiver. "I think I might prefer death."
"I may agree with you," Rezkin said. Actually, the thought disturbed him deeply. These were outworlders, though, and they lived by different rules. He said, "Do you believe we should give them a choice?"
Malsius was silent for a moment and then said,
"No, they would probably choose death on principle alone. It would be better to do it and hope they appreciate our mercy later."
"Very well,"
Rezkin said, before stepping into the adjacent room where Oren and one of his men were finishing their preparations. They had collected additional healing supplies, food, and perhaps a few valuables during their short stay.
"It is time for you to leave."
"You're not joining us?"
Rezkin glanced at Farson, who was covering the fact that he was spying on the mercenaries by grumbling as he appeared to be mending the broken straps on his armor.
Rezkin said, "I'll catch up. We have unfinished business here."
Oren's expression darkened.
The soldiers. What exactly do you intend to do with them?"
Rezkin flicked the pommel of his sword at his hip.
"You let me worry about that. Can't have no witnesses, so unless you want to join them, you'd best be getting along. The boss and the rest of the men will go with you, except for Wes."
"You sure the boy can handle that sort of thing?"
Oren said.
"He seems a bit weak in the stomach. I heard him muttering all night over in the corner."
"He'll survive."
"Well, let's hope we don't get attacked by Draugliks before you catch up."
Farson coughed, and Rezkin glanced over to see his former trainer's telling look. It was one he had seen often as a small man, one that meant he had forgotten something. Mercenaries liked to gloat.
"I ain't your nursemaid," he said. "I seem to remember you saying I was the kind to give mercs a bad name."
Rezkin was never in the mood for banter, but on this day he was feeling uncomfortable with his chosen course of action. He knew he should just kill the prisoners. Letting them live was to leave enemies at his back. It was a mistake, but it was one he had to make if he desired to preserve his friends' honor and their respect.
"You're a right cocky bastard," said Oren. "But I guess you got reason to be."
The man collected his pack with his one good hand and limped toward the door. He paused and said,
"You just remember, the bigger your head, the easier the target."
Rezkin grinned and nodded appreciatively, but Oren scoffed at the perceived sarcasm. He followed the two mercenaries and Farson into the adjacent room, and then they all continued out the front door while Rezkin remained behind with Wesson. He watched out the window as his friends mounted their newly acquired horses and started down the road. Farson did not go with them. He waited at the edge of the property with Pride and Wesson's mount.
Rezkin had thought the journeyman who had once aspired to be a life mage and had shed tears for a donkey would have wanted to choose his own horse, but Wesson had shown no interest. Once they were gone, Wesson looked up at him.
I don't like this, he said.
I know, but the alternative is death.
This might be worse. I do not know for sure what will happen. I've never tried this spell, and normally I would never test a spell like this on a person. Actually, I would never use a spell like this on a person, even if it were tested and accepted.
You are the one who suggested it, Rezkin said.
Well, yes, I know, but it was just an idea. I did not think you would approve.
You have seen the spell used before and other things?
No, not exactly,
Wesson replied as he glanced away. He sighed heavily and said,
I made it up. I've been studying the structure of the Citadel and considering the Shielria. I mean, this really has nothing to do with that, but it was what gave me the idea. The Mage Academy would say it is impossible. It requires mixing two affinities in a way they are not supposed to be combined.
But you think you can do it?
Maybe. It might work, but not necessarily in the way I expect. Or they might explode.
Rezkin raised an eyebrow.
Explode?
Wesson scratched his head and wrung his hands, since he could not fidget with his robes as usual.
It uses mostly constructive power, and it is new and probably a little beyond my ability to control, considering my affinity for Nocent. Also, I will be performing it on living beings who are not willing participants.
That makes a difference?
Yes, it can. Mundanes also bear the power of will. Even healers have trouble treating patients who do not desire aid. It is one of the reasons life mages are not great in battle. Can you imagine? Besides battle mages, they would be the most powerful on the field if they could simply change a person's body in the midst of a skirmish.
I see a point. Are you ready to perform the spell?
Wesson nodded.
Yes. I've been practicing all night. If these men can avoid the fate of the purifiers, I will do what I must. It is worth a try.
The courtyard was an outdoor space in the center of the building with a perimeter of potted plants and flower boxes. In the center was a swirling design made of flat paving stones. Although it was open to the sky, it was partially covered by an overgrown trellis. The splash of color from the fragrant red blooms was the most vibrant ornamentation they had seen in Gendishin thus far. The tables and chairs that had previously occupied the courtyard had been stacked in one corner, and the 10 Gendishin soldiers were tied in a line down the center. Rezkin paced around the group once, then said, "We are going to allow you to live." There was a collective sigh of relief, and the younger soldier's shoulders shook as he began to sob. We cannot let you go now, obviously, since you will return to your fort and report this misunderstanding in your favor.
No, we wouldn't,
said one of the men closest to him.
We tell them what really happened. The dirt man messed up. We know it.
It no longer matters. Whatever you tell them, they will come after us, and we do not have time for that. It would be equally tiresome to have to needlessly kill more of your comrades. So you all need to consent to what we are about to do so that you can remain alive.
What are you going to do?
The man asked. It does not matter. You choose, alive or dead. The youngest soldier sobbed harder, and Rezkin wondered how he had ever made it through basic training. Rezkin shook his head and said, Here is what is going to happen. We are going to untie you and give each of you a sword because you may need them later. If you make trouble, I will kill you. And believe me when I tell you that the two of us are more than enough to handle the 10 of you. The men appeared to contemplate the claim and seemed to accept that Rezkin could do some damage, but they glanced at Wesson doubtfully.
Give them a demonstration so they do not do anything foolish, Rezkin said.
Wesson nodded and then snapped his hands through the air. A raging stream of fire burst over the soldiers' heads, singeing the leaves on the trellis as the golden flame exposed the terror on their shadowed faces. Shouts of scourge and afflicted and demon could be heard under the thunderous roar of flame. Rezkin looked at the mage and said,
That was a little dramatic.
Wesson grinned and met the most determined soldier's anxious gaze.
Sorry, I tried to rein it in, but I got excited.
We are the purifiers,
shouted one man. Wesson glanced at Rezkin and then said,
The purifiers are dead. They were given a chance to repent, but they could not be swayed.
Rezkin and Wesson untied the soldiers, who each hurried to put distance between himself and the mage. They were instructed to collect a sword from the pile and then stand in a circle in the center of the courtyard facing outward. Once the men were in place, Wesson began weaving the difficult spell. Rezkin watched him with interest, the process seeming needlessly complicated. To the mundane soldiers, the mage appeared to be erratically waving his hands in the air as he muttered. But when Rezkin focused, he could see the complex tapestry of Vimara that started with Wesson's hands and then expanded outward and around the entire room. Wesson began cinching it inward, the weave getting tighter as it wrapped around the soldiers.
Rez, you might want to leave,
Wesson said, the waver in his voice barring his concern. What is the problem? Rezkin said. The men began to panic, even more so once they realized their feet were rooted to the ground.
Well, you kind of got wrapped in the spell and, I'm not sure you can get out of it.
As Rezkin stared, he noticed a small, splotched cat had come to sit beside the mage. It watched the proceedings with interest and did not seem concerned in the least by the commotion. It will be fine. Continue, Rezkin said.
I appreciate your confidence in my abilities, Wesson said through gritted teeth. But this would not be the spell with which to test yourself.
Wesson threaded the last strand into the spell, splitting it into multiple lines and attaching one end to the trickle of Vimara within each of the men. The soldier's Vimara began to seep into the spell, keeping it powered as Wesson withdrew his own. He breathed a sigh of relief and looked at Rezkin, who was wrapped in threads as well.
All right. It's tied off. I can activate it when you are ready.
Wait! What are you doing to us? We deserve to know!
Shouted one of the soldiers. Wesson looked at the frightened faces of the men on his side of the circle.
Did your mother ever tell you not to make an ugly face, because it would freeze that way?
The one who had asked said,
Yeah, I guess so. Well, that is what is about to happen. To your whole body.
Rezkin grinned and said, So strike a daring pose. Wesson frowned.
It will be temporary, he said with an anxious glance at Rezkin. But it will keep you from reporting to the fort while we go about our business. The Drowglik should not even take notice of you if this works, but we do not know the circumstances in which you will find yourselves when it wears off, hence the sword.
Wait! You can't do this!
It is better than death,
Wesson said again, more for himself than for them, since he was uncertain they would survive the spell. Rezkin nodded, and Wesson ignored the men's shouts as he activated the spell. A silent concussion of power swept outward from the center, and then was just as suddenly sucked inward in a bone-jarring implosion. Panic surged through him as he worried over his potential mistakes. When he was not showered in gore, he finally filled his lungs with the air he so badly needed. Wesson watched as the spell began to take hold, and the men yanked furiously at their failing limbs.
They are going to hurt themselves, he muttered.
Rezkin glanced at the cat, and then focused, pressing his will on the men who were already under the influence of a powerful spell.
Attention! He shouted.
The combination of Wesson's spell and whatever power was behind Rezkin's will produced the desired effect. Like the well-trained recruits they were, their frantic motions ceased, and each of the men abruptly came to attention, a ring of soldiers bearing arms. Their skin and hair became pale, and then turned white as their breathing slowed to naught. Their clothes and swords were changed as well, and within seconds, the soldiers had become phenomenally detailed statues, their exquisite forms refined by the imperfections of 10 unique individuals. Rezkin felt the spell slither over his skin, but with each grasp and tug, its tendrils failed to gain purchase, slipping away ineffectually. The stone pressed against the skin over his sternum turned cold, and a sense of alien anger invaded a small and distant part of his mind. His gaze urgently sought the cat, but it was no longer resting at Wesson's feet. In fact, it had penetrated his space without him noticing and was sitting only a pace away, glaring. Its attention was not on him, though. It was on his chest, exactly where the stone lay hidden beneath his shirt and armor on the lace around his neck. The cat stared intently, and then its yellow eyes flashed orange. Seemingly in response, the stone heated to an uncomfortable burn. Then the cat met his gaze and blinked, its accusatory expression becoming haughty and judgmental. Rezkin tore his eyes from the cat to see Wesson watching the strange, silent exchange between man and tiny beast. Ignoring the cat, Rezkin dragged his fingers down the face of one of the statues and found that it felt like any natural stone carving. "Are they aware?" he asked.
"I do not believe so,"
Wesson said as he stared into one soldier's empty gaze.
"They are stone throughout, mind and body."
Rezkin ran his finger along the stone that used to be a blade.
"How is this temporary, then?"
Wesson's expression was worried.
"I am not sure that it is. I tried to tie the aura to the spell. I am no necromancer, but I thought maybe I had achieved a connection with the Chiandre. The spell was supposed to mimic the properties of stone while maintaining the body's ability to support the soul, and also preserving the soul's connection between the body and the afterlife. This..."
He looked deeply into the eyes of the statue.
"It's so complete. It is amazing. I've never heard of anyone transforming a living being into stone."
Then, remembering his subjects, his eyes began to tear.
"I can no longer sense the power of the spell, though. I think I messed up. I'm afraid I've killed them."
"Time will tell, journeyman," Rezkin said. "The Draugliks will not be interested in stone, and they will be armed when they awaken."
"If the spell is already dissipated, then they are surely done. I designed it to become unstable as their Vimara drops. When it dipped below a certain threshold, the spell would no longer receive power and it would collapse. It is why I could not have used it on the purifiers. Their wills were deep. They would have remained embedded in stone for centuries, maybe longer. With these mundanes, it should have lasted a month or two at most. If the spell has already ceased, though, and they have not changed back, then they are dead."
"We tried," Rezkin said. "Remember, any one of them would have killed you had he known what you are. They would have killed the rest of us on the unfounded assumption that we killed the residents of this plantation."
"I know,"
Wesson said with a nod.
"Really, I do."
"Then what distresses you?" Rezkin asked.
Wesson turned. He looked like he wanted to say something, but the words were not strong enough to pass his lips. Finally, he whispered,
"Another time, perhaps."
After days of plodding down the busy road that led from the coast through Berglen and Tann to the inland capital of Drovsk, the dark smudge on the horizon took form. Orin and his men had elected to travel separately, hoping the physical distance between the two parties would be enough to detach them from the events at the plantation. Luckily, it appeared the Draugliks had either avoided or had not yet reached the somewhat more populated south. The long approach to the king's seat gave the travelers ample time to survey the city's unusual architecture. For those who had been graced with the sight of it, nothing could compare to the splendor of Kailarum, but anyone besides the Gendishan would agree that Drovsk was ugly. The surrounding landscape was hidden by crops and wild fields, no mountain, forest, or sea in sight. It appeared as though some weary traveler from long ago had given up after weeks of trudging through endless plains and decided to build a city where he stood. Without the luxury of natural defenses, a monstrous wall had sprouted to surround the castle at the center. As the city grew, more walls had been built. But rather than surrounding the entire city over and again, as in Sarrett, each consecutive wall encapsulated only the newly built structures. Rezkin imagined that if he could view the city as a hawk, it would look like a senseless mosaic. The only entrance was through the gate at the end of the road. Once inside, travelers had to navigate a nonsensical maze of gateways, each with guards determining who was permitted into the respective sector. Rezkin's group stopped long before they reached the city, though. A blockade manned by soldiers had been erected across the road, and picket lines of tall, sharpened posts and crossbeams had been planted along the sides of the road leading to the gate. Some travelers and merchants were permitted passage, but the mercenaries and young men hoping to enlist in the regular army were sent to camps on either side of the road. The mercenary camp was far less orderly, but the men there strutted with greater confidence and seemed to be thrilled with the prospect of war. Fights broke out between the different companies and sometimes among members of the same company, and veterans often jeered at the Green Army recruits who wandered too close to the road. Kai led the party to hide amongst the tallest grasses they could find, using the grazing horses to break the line of sight to the road. Once there, they quickly changed out of their worn attire to something more suited to a king's entourage. Rezkin donned the guise of Dark Tidings, and the others wore tabards bearing the green lightning bolt on a black field. Wesson quietly muttered to himself about the fact that he was unable to wear the robes he had painstakingly earned as he brushed down the pants and tunic befitting the king's manservant. "Remember," Rezkin said, "you are all warriors now. You are the king's warriors."
"We are too small in number to be convincing," Malsius said as he plaited his hair.
Farsa nodded toward the stream of travelers on the road who were attempting to reach the capital.
"While our party is small and lacks the typical fanfare of a royal arrival, our sudden and unannounced appearance at the capital's gate should have an impact."
Malsius tied the ribbon at the end of his braid and said,
"I suppose that makes sense, but what if they just arrest us?"
Farsan glanced from Kai to Rezkin.
"That would not be in their best interest."
Malsius scowled, an expression that had, of late, nearly replaced his previously untroubled visage.
"Two strikers, a swordmaster, and a... whatever he is," he waved toward Rezkin, "are not enough to take on a kingdom,"
Brandt said in a forced whisper.
"Do not forget the battle mage,
who will surely be found out by these purifiers. What can one mage do?"
Farson shook his head as he began stuffing his items into his pack.
"I've not seen Mage Wesson use his talent in such a way, but even a weak mage with a natural affinity for destructive magic can cause significant damage."
Isaria, who had been pointedly avoiding direct interaction with Malsius, finally snapped.
"If you do not wish to be here, why did you come?"
His fiery gaze struck the woman.
"No one wishes to be here. I want to make sure things are getting done."
Isaria laughed.
"And what do you think to do if they are not? It is your fault we are in this mess,"
he said as he closed the distance. Isaria met the lord's hostile approach in kind and yelled,
"How is it my fault that we must prevent a war with Gandishan while claiming their land? If it were not for you, Pallas would be alive. We could return to Ashai and lead a campaign against the tyrant in the name of House Jabai. I could stand before my father with honor. I was responsible for him. How am I to return now, having lost my brother?"
Rezkin was glad that Malsius was finally putting voice to his festering resentment, but the circumstances at that moment were not ideal.
"Isaria is not responsible for Pallas's death, Malsius. He was his own man, and he made his choice."
"If she had done what she was supposed to, he would not have gone back for her, and he would not be dead."
Isaria thrust a long, slender finger in Rezkin's direction.
"I did what I was supposed to do. I protected my king." "Who ordered you to return to the ship?"
argued Malsius. Kai interrupted Isaria's response.
"I gave her the order to stay with Rezkin no matter what. She is a member of the king's royal guard. It is her duty to protect her king with her life."
"But the king ordered her to leave."
Kai dropped his pack and turned to Malsius.
"It is the responsibility of the royal guard to ignore such orders if it appears the king's life is in immediate danger. Rezkin was alone on the beach with an army bearing down on him. If I had not been otherwise engaged on the ship, I would have been there too." Isaria acted with courage, not just in facing the enemy, but also for risking the wrath of her king to do so. By tradition, her act of bravery would have been recorded in the Book of Honors, placing her one step closer to official knighthood. As it is, she has endured only the guilt and resentment associated with your brother's death, the death of her potential betrothed, no less."
Malsius's nostrils flared. He glanced between them and then turned and stormed farther into the grass. Since there was no place in which to find privacy, he had to settle for distance. As Farson stood to follow, Rezkin said,
"Keep an eye on him, but give him some space."
"What do you know of space?" Farson snapped. "You would not have required it."
Rezkin shook his head. "He has not learned to separate from his emotions. Outworlders must be permitted time to battle with their feelings before they can be expected to function with sense.
An astute observation, Farson said cautiously.
Rezkin picked up the black sword from the wrap that lay on the ground and thrust it into the scabbard strapped to his back.
It is inefficient and needlessly draining of energy, but it is their reality. Still, we have little time. I do not wish for our presence to be reported before our arrival. Brandt, give him a few minutes, and then encourage his return.
Brandt nodded and jogged into the grass, followed by Farson. A short time later, they were all in the saddle heading toward the blockade. Unlike other travelers, they did not dismount upon arrival. They held back until the travelers in front of them had been processed and no one behind attempted to pass. The travelers, mercenaries, and soldiers watched with interest, and eventually, whispers of dark tidings encouraged others from the camps to crowd the road. The soldiers at the barricade looked on anxiously as the new arrivals plodded forward in the final approach. The officer in charge was easily identified. A silver chain stretched across his chest from one shoulder to the other. From the chain dangled the various emblems of rank and awards he had earned throughout his career. This man had many, which meant he had either found himself uncharacteristically in trouble or, more likely, the kingdom considered the barricade position to be of great importance.
"We demand an audience with King Privath," Dark Tidings said from behind the mask. The officer glanced between the mounted warriors. Each was wearing a black tabard bearing a green lightning bolt and a hooded black cloak, beneath which were shadowed faces painted with thick black lines running vertically from the hairline, through the eyes, over the cheeks, and ending at the jawline. The only member of the party not dressed in such a way was the priest of the Maker, who rode at the back.
"Who should I say is calling?"
the officer asked, and the mutterings of Dark Tidings grew louder.
"Tell him the King of Kyle, true King of Ashai, has arrived," said Dark Tidings.
The officer turned to the soldier at his side and said,
"Get my horse and one for the fire."
To Dark Tidings, he said,
"I am Maya Lua. I will deliver the message personally. This is Firevolt. He will take you to the Overgress."
Dark Tidings tilted his head in acceptance. They followed the Maya and Fire into the city, the blockade preventing anyone from following, at least to the first gate. Within the gates, the road split into two parallel paths, one for use by riders, wagons, and official business, and the other open to pedestrians. While people began crowding the footpath to watch their procession, none crossed the boundary to interfere with their passage. Rezkin appreciated the order of it, having been uncomfortable with the crowded chaos of the cities he had visited thus far. He supposed the paths needed to be clear if one was to navigate the discordant honeycomb that was Drovsk. The party was led through increasingly attractive sections of the city. Eventually, the Maiar left to report to the castle. The fire led them to an empty plaza, in the center of which was a stone dais. Around the perimeter were rows of steps that rose to an upper walkway lined by a stone colonnade.
"This is the Overgress," the fire said.
As they entered, soldiers quietly slipped into the spaces between the columns. The fire invented the party to dismount, but Rezkin remained in his saddle, a signal to his companions to do the same. People dressed in colorful court finery began to trickle into the plaza to take up seats on the steps. They muttered and pointed, and some laughed, but it was anxious laughter. As they waited, the assembly grew more uncomfortable with the mounted warriors in black who were obviously uninterested in socializing. Pride had been trained to keep his nickering and snorts to a minimum when commanded to do so, but the other horses were becoming restless. Eventually, a trio of brown-robed men descended the steps. The soldiers between the columns spread apart, and seven more brown-robed men stepped into the spaces between them. Rezkin could feel the buzz of mage power, and it grew to a roar before the lead purifier came to a halt a few paces from him.
"Afflicted,"
the man hissed, and he lifted his hand to point a crooked finger at Wesson. A wave of angry shouts and fear-filled shrieks passed through the crowd, and the soldiers raised their bows in answer.
"Surrender him to us," the purifier said.
"No, but you are welcome to try to take him. You will not survive the encounter. He cannot unleash his foul scourge in this sacred place. The runes...
Wesson produced a ball of swirling fire over his open palm.
Are ineffectual,
Dark Tidings said.
Seize him!
The purifier shrieked. The purifiers raised their arms, and Wesson's fireball fizzled in a thin puff. Wesson was overwhelmed with alarm as the power of 10 mages wrapped around him. He felt imprisoned, trapped. His outward calm was in complete contrast to the internal battle he was waging against the confines of power. He knew Rezkin could probably feel the purifier's attack, but if so, he gave no indication. After the initial panic began to subside, Wesson realized the restraints felt wobbly and frayed. Part of him was still wondering how he was able to fight them at all. He had seen the numerous runes carved into the columns, roof, and floor, and he should not have been able to light a candle, much less create a fireball. Even now, he could feel his strength mounting, and he knew that if he kept pressing, he could overcome the assault. Whether he could do it in time to save himself was another matter.
I invoke the rule of the Interkingdom Accords, said Dark Tidings. The mage cannot be touched. As you have seen, he is not as limited as you hoped. The Inter-Kingdom Accords apply only to monarchs and diplomats, the purifier replied. You are neither.
Stand down, mage, Dark Tidings said, eliciting a deep scowl from the purifier and a flurry of angry grumbles from the crowd. That is not your decision to make.
He nodded toward another man descending the steps.
The purifiers turned and bowed toward the new arrival.
King Privov paused at the base of the steps, and Dark Tidings finally dismounted. His warriors followed in unison, maintaining positions beside their mounts. It was a display they had practiced to proficiency.
You are audacious, said Privath, to come here to my kingdom, to demand an audience with the king, to bring with you but a handful of warriors, to deliver unto us this scourge-infested demon kind. If you think to intimidate me, as you did Ionius, you will be disappointed.
Privath was a young king of merely 30 years. His brown hair was cropped short in the Gendishan military style, as was his short pointy beard. He wore the uniform of a soldier, but with a ruby-encrusted gold crown atop his head, and 5 embellished gold chains stretching across his chest. He carried himself with the assurance of a general, but unlike most of the monarchs about the Soelian, Privath had earned an officer's rank before taking the throne.
Dark Tidings said, I do not come to press or beg.
He grasped the black mask and pulled it from his face.
But to bargain.
He met Privath's hard stare and was pleased to see the dutifully concealed surprise in the king's dark eyes. Unlike his warriors, Rezkin had not painted his face. The strikers and the baron had said they saw in him a resemblance to the Ashayan royal family, and he wanted Privath to see it too.
Majesty, the lead purifier said. The afflicted—
Yes, Privath said, diverting his attention.
Read him.
Rezkin felt a rise in the buzz of mage power directed at Wesson. The purifier's face contorted in anger, an anger that gradually morphed from righteous indignation to fear.
He is strong. No, too strong. He wields inconceivable destructive power. Your Majesty, we cannot hold him. He will break free. I implore you to seek safety. We must kill him now before his power is released.
King Privath was unmoved. He stood, stoic, as he examined the black-clad warriors who remained as still and unperturbed as their leader. The purifier stepped closer to his king and hissed too low for any but Rezkin to hear.
Your Majesty, we cannot wait. Why do you delay?
I wait for him,
said Privath with a nod toward Rezkin. The purifier stared at his king.
Have they used their demon-gotten power to corrupt your mind?
Privath sounded as if he were schooling a child as he spoke.
Look at them. They do not appear concerned. Why are they not concerned?
He turned hard eyes on his zealous servant.
Lead him.
The purifier looked doubtfully at Rezkin, but did as his king bade him. The tingle of power slipped over Rezkin, and he could feel it trying to grasp something within, but nothing answered. The purifier shook violently and stepped back.
He is cold.
It is a deep, bitter cold, and disturbing, but he is not one of them.
What does it mean? Privith said.
The purifier lifted his nose and said,
I am sure it is nothing. He has probably spent too much time in the presence of the scourge afflicted.
Privith appeared unsatisfied with the answer. He raised his voice and said,
Bring the old woman.
A runner dashed away beyond the colonnade. Rezkin spent the next few minutes studying the spectators and guards while Privith studied him and his companions. He nodded in appreciation of Minder Finwë's presence, and then the man's gaze lingered on Isseria, which was not surprising. Women were not permitted the same freedoms in Gendishin as they were in Ashai. Aside from that, even Rezkin had noticed that the woman looked particularly stunning in her present attire. Her pale, freckled skin glowed beneath the black cloak and tabard. Her green eyes were like fire blazing through the darkness of the black paint, and a few stray red curls danced around her face in the shadow of her hood. With her determined gaze and the array of exposed weapons, she was a beautiful but deadly viper. Rezkin thought her well suited to play the role of enchantress. His attention flicked to the top of the stairs. An old woman in a worn frock made of layers of colorful fabric was shuffling down the steps with the aid of the young runner. Long silver hair, streaked white with a few remaining black strands, was tied back in a tail that hung past her waist. Her skin was pale, wrinkled, and marked with many years of age spots. When she reached the base of the steps, she paused and looked up at their party. Her aged gray eyes flashed with intrigue when her gaze landed upon Wesson.
Greetings, young one. It has been many years,
the old woman said.
You are underdressed.
Rezkin glanced back at his mage. Wesson appeared startled and uncertain if he should speak.
You are acquainted? Rezkin asked.
Yes,
Wesson replied. He turned to the old woman and performed a shallow bow.
Greetings, Master Rita Kessa. It is an honor to be in your company.
Rezkin looked back at the old woman. Her eyes flashed with mirth as she said,
King Privith is wise to treat you all well.
Privith said,
What is this? What do you know?
She looked at Wesson with a pleased smile.
I am certain your purifiers have already told you what you need to know.
I will be the judge of that. You were invited here to teach and to serve me. Do as I say, and answer the question.
Kessa pursed her lips and frowned at the young king.
King Privith, you do not understand how an invitation is supposed to work.
She glanced from Wesson to Rezkin.
With an invitation, the recipient has the option to refuse.
Answer the question, old woman, Privith said.
Kessa pointed at Wesson.
I know that no one can force that one to do anything he does not wish to do. You would be wise not to press him.
Her gray gaze turned to Rezkin.
I know that if this one has managed to garner the loyalty of the mage, then he is most dangerous.
Privith growled in frustration.
Do you know him as well?
No, I do not. But the likeness is enough. Do you not agree? In which case, you should be very concerned.
Read him, Privith demanded.
Kessa gazed, unfocused, at Rezkin for a long time. She became unnaturally still, and her lips began to turn blue. Her focus returned, and she shivered violently.
Cold,
she said through chattering teeth, and a puff of frosty air escaped her lips. She pulled her shawl tighter around her and studied Rezkin's face anew. Privith prompted,
What does it mean?
He is not a mage, Kessa said. I can say this with certainty.
Then what is he?
The old woman shrugged.
A man?
At Privith's dissatisfied look, she said,
He is probably under the influence of a spell, one that I cannot see.
She nodded toward Wesson.
He may be capable of such a thing.
Privith looked pointedly at the woman and said,
If he is not afflicted, then he cannot be of the Ashayan royal line.
Kessa looked at Rezkin skeptically.
That I do not believe.
The purifier stepped forward with a gleeful grin.
Your Majesty, perhaps he has been cured.
What if the power of the fiery hells has been ripped from him, leaving behind a frozen, purified vessel?
Rezkin did not like the idea that a piece of his innate being had been stolen. He said to the purifier, "You bear the talent, same as the mage. It is the source of your power."
"We bear the curse of demon power, so that we may identify and bind those afflicted with the scourge. It cannot be used any other way. The Maker deemed it so and blessed us with these runes."
He waved a finger around the adorned structure.
"To assist in our crusade."
Rezkin glanced at the runes. "These were created by mages like you and him. How you choose to use your power is your prerogative, but we both know you are capable of much more." Kessa grinned, and Privath glanced at the fuming purifier. He lifted his hand to forestall the imminent vicious tirade. To Rezkin he said, "You are clever. I recognize your attempt to divide us, and it will not work." "I seek only to expose the truth of your hypocrisy," Rezkin said.
"Like my fathers before me, it is my prerogative to use whatever resources are available to maintain the balance of this kingdom."
"By balance, you mean the existing power structure?"
"Indeed. For it is by the blessing of the Maker that my family has ruled this kingdom for 12 generations. You said you came here to bargain. You call yourself the King of Kyle, true King of Ashai. By your looks alone, I might be inclined to believe the latter has some substance. Kyle, however, belongs to me."
"Ionia said the same."
"Chenaria has only ever claimed that worthless rock to vex us. Now it seems they have given it to you, but with a few stipulations." Privath chuckled. "I hear he gave to you his daughter. You must have been very convincing in your methods. In the matter of Kyle, though, I believe Ionius said that I must recognize your claim."
"It is interesting that he should do so."
"Our people have never agreed on anything regarding Kyle, and now we should consent to give it to you."
"What incentive do I have?" "I have more resources than either you or Ionius realize."
"Oh?" Privath smirked. "I heard you went to Ionius practically begging for favor."
Rezkin grinned devilishly. "Men hear what they wish. Men of power, especially." Privath's expression soured.
"I can only assume your candidness is designed to convince me of my own desire to give you my land."
"On the contrary, I have no need of your gift. As I said, I came to bargain."
"Very well. What is it you have that I should want?"
"You and your predecessors have been seeking an alliance with the tribes of the Eastern Mountains for more than 100 years. A trade relay would be of great value, particularly one bearing a strong force in the mountains that could assist with that nasty Drowglik problem." Once again, Privath hid his surprise well.
"That would be a valuable deal indeed. One that I do not believe you are capable of delivering."
"For Kyle, it will be so," Rezkin said.
"Why do you want it?"
Privath snapped. Rezkin smiled. "We are refugees. It is our home. What would one not do for one's home?" Privath scoffed. He glanced at the assembly, pausing on the rows of counselors and military officers, and then on his 4 daughters who were present out of the 8. When he turned back, Rezkin could see that he had not been swayed.
"What you offer is a worthy price, but I do not accept. There is something else of greater value, and I will accept nothing in its stead."
Rezkin had anticipated a counteroffer, but not complete rejection. As such, he was left in wonder as to what Privath would demand. He did not like entering negotiations lacking such knowledge. Regardless, he gave the king a knowing look and said, "What is your price?"
"The Sword of Eiri."
Rezkin waited, but nothing more was forthcoming. It was not at all what he had expected. He schooled his features to appear unfazed, but truly, he was at a loss. "You desire the Sword of Eiri, the sword that is said to rest beside your very own throne?" King Privath frowned, but glanced back at the counselors. He balled his fist and looked back to Rezkin. "The sword beside the throne is a fraud, a blight on my house. The real Sword of Eiri was stolen on the day of my father's death. I will have that sword returned, even if I must bargain with you to get it." "You would trade Kyle for a single sword?"
"It is not just any sword," Privath shouted. "It is the Sword of Eiri!"
Where previously stood a sensible military commander, now brooded a fanatic. The man's behavior was in contradiction to all the reports Rezkin had received. He cautiously said, I understand the sword has mythical significance.
It is not a myth, Privath said. The sword is bound in prophecy. As such, this kingdom is bound to it as well. The prophecy is as old as the kingdom.
Gendishan is 1100 years old. The Sword of Eirie was forged only 200 years ago, Rezkin said.
Of course, the sword did not exist when the prophecy was spoken,
Privath said, as if it were obvious.
And still the sword exists, and every king since its creation has ruled with it at his side, knowing that he could be the king of prophecy. Every king but me.
But the prophecy states that the sword will burst a flame, Rezkin said, and the kings of Gendishan do not bear the talent.
It is not the demon-cursed scourge that impels the prophecy, but the might of the Maker's cleansing power. Oh, I have spoken with the purifiers. I know that the scourge fire cannot be embedded in a blade, and the afflicted cannot brace the fire to the blade long enough to satisfy the remainder of the prophecy. It is proof that the Maker's grace and the blood of a mighty ruler of Gendishan is that which will bring forth the glory foretold in the prophecy.
What is the remainder of the prophecy? Rezkin asked. Although the beginning was common knowledge, a story told in legends, the final passages of the prophecy had been kept secret for so long, most believed them forever lost. The king's gaze cleared, as if night had abruptly turned to day. It is none of your concern. He shook a finger at Rezkin and said,
Do not think I am unaware of what happened to my men. You came up from the coast where three purifiers and a double patrol disappeared. 10 of them turned to stone. As soon as I was told of your arrival, I knew it was you. You and that demon cursed.
Rezkin shrugged with nonchalance and said, We were on a peaceful diplomatic mission, during which we were unjustly detained and assaulted on our way to meet with you, the king. We had every right to defend ourselves.
I do not need your excuses. It is because of this that I think you might have a chance at succeeding. If you fail, a thorn will have been plucked from my side, and I will have lost nothing.
Bring to me the Sword of Eirie, and Kyle is yours.
I think you will not be so eager once you learn of its taker.
Indeed, the news was grim. Rezkin had no desire to contend with Privath's problem, but it was the price he had to pay to acquire Kyle and maintain peaceful relations with both Gendishan and Chenaria. Privath dismissed the court, and at Kessa's assurance that the guards and purifiers would be ineffective, he begrudgingly instructed them to go as well. Only the king's personal guard and the old woman remained for the revelation. Rezkin later regretted that he could not have dismissed his own entourage for this particular news. Once Privath revealed who had stolen the sword, he turned away to instruct his guards to gather an escort. Kessa stepped closer and brushed her frail fingers across Rezkin's hand. She held his gaze, her focus so intent, he thought she might have been trying to communicate with him through her mind, and he was disappointed that he could not hear her. She said,
I wish for your success, and hope that you return safely with the prize, so that you may help your people. All of your people.
The king called the old reader away, and she departed without another glance. The armed escort led Rezkin and his party to a guest house where they were to stay the night. The place was barely a step above servants' quarters, with only 2 small rooms besides the common room and a single hearth to heat the entire structure. The furnishings were functional, and by the layer of dust that had accumulated, it appeared the place had not seen company in quite some time. It also had no cistern or running water, so Farson stepped out to search for the well. Since Wesson's status had been exposed, he was free to ward the residents against eavesdroppers and uninvited guests.
This is an insult, Malsius grumbled.
It is meant to be, Kai said as he piled a few logs onto the hearth.
Malsius slapped dust from the seat of a chair with an equally dusty rag he had found in a cupboard.
You are a king, Rez. You should not put up with this.
To react would be to let him win, Rezkin said. He is a military man. To complain about these lodgings, which are luxurious compared to an army camp, would be to admit weakness.
How did they get so many readers?
Wesson said to no one in particular.
They are so rare.
Rezkin found a cauldron in a cabinet beside the hearth and began wiping it clean.
What are you doing? Said Malsius.
Is it not obvious? I'm cleaning the pot so that we can make dinner.
Sergeant Millens gingerly walked over, offering to perform the task, and Rezkin acquiesced only because he had other concerns. Wesson mumbled,
Perhaps it is unlike other talents, and breeds more strongly in the blood.
Why would you need to make dinner? Malsius said. We're on palace grounds. We are guests, even if they do not care to have us here. I'm sure they will prepare a meal for us.
We will not be eating anything they serve, Rezkin said. You should know better.
So, lame travelers stew again?
Rezkin glanced up from inspecting the underside of the table.
Lame? I thought you liked my stew.
Isaria sat down in the chair Malsius had just finished dusting, much to his chagrin, and said,
Ignore him. He's a spoiled noble who doesn't appreciate what others do for him.
Malsius's eyes widened in fury.
I could lash you for such insolence!
Isaria laughed.
You think you could? I'd like to see you try.
So would I, said Brandt with a snicker.
Malsius blurted,
Rez! This woman is insufferable!
Isaria batted her lashes and said,
Oh, Lord Malsius, do you always go running to Daddy for help?
Malsius spun around and growled in frustration. When he turned back, he waved a hand at the woman and said,
You look stupid made up like that, by the way.
Isaria stood and narrowed her eyes at Malsius, a retort hanging on her lips. Rezkin could not see what Malsius found offensive in her attire. He went back to examining the contents of the trunk beside the divan and said,
I think she looks powerful and sensuous. A goddess of war.
His senses went on alert as the room suddenly became still and silent. He glanced up to see everyone staring at him. Isaria's face flamed nearly as red as her hair. Malsius gave her an uncomfortable glance and then stomped into the adjacent room, slamming the door behind him.
What? Rezkin said.
No one said anything, but Farson stood in the doorway with a smirk, shaking his head. He thought for a moment, and then looked at Wesson.
I think they are stealing them.
Wesson blinked several times as his brain worked to catch up.
What?
The readers. You said they're extremely rare in all the other kingdoms. Master Reader Kessa did not join Privath willingly. I think they may be hunting and kidnapping them.
Wesson nodded.
Yes, that would make sense. It would be even easier, considering readers are apparently born with ability to see the talent. It does not activate in them later in life, like other mages, although their other powers will, if they have any. Not all readers can perform spells. When I first met Master Reader Kessa, she explained that the more powerful the reader, the smaller the chance of his or her having any other affinities. It also would make them easier to capture and control. Plus, if they take them very young, they can raise them to believe in their twisted doctrine.
Brandt said, If they hate mages so much, why do they want the sword? What good is it if they do not believe in the prophecy?
Kai sat in the chair Isaria had vacated and said,
Oh, they believe in magic. They believe in the prophecy strongly, I might add. They just hate power they cannot control, and the prophecy is a favorable one for the king.
I thought prophecies were myth, Brandt said. I have never heard of any prophets. Not real ones, anyway.
Rezkin said, According to ancient Adonaiic texts, prophecy is reserved for the blessed of Mikael, the god of the soul and knowledge, also sometimes referred to as the god of war. Mages are the blessed of Reyna, the goddess of the firmament and the realm of the living, and thus they do not possess the power of prophecy. I have not heard or read of any blessed of Mikael since the prophecy of the sword was foretold. The prophecy was recorded 1200 years ago by a knight of Mikael, although he noted that he was not the prophet. He was merely one of the graced.
Graced? Blessed? What does all that mean?
Brandt said. Rezkin noted the brown and black feline that abruptly jumped from outside to sit on the windowsill beside where Minder Finwë was standing. The others stared at the cat as well. He knew that everyone was unnerved by the furry little creature that tended to appear and disappear at will, and seemed to follow him everywhere without trouble, but it was a conversation he was not ready to broach.
It is a long story, Rezkin said. It is a tale of the beginning of time, and of the land, and of the sky. of different realms and of all the peoples who have dwelled within them. In this realm, the realm of the living, the story does not begin with humans. There were ancient beings and peoples long before us. That is the tale of the Anan, Daiman, and Antep. Unfortunately, the few remaining records of such things were poorly preserved, and most of the knowledge has been lost with time.